because the vast majority of people who take up the cross and follow Jesus don't speak English. I'm going to read the text also in English because the people sitting here, by and large, do speak English. So I've been asked to read that passage in an English rendering. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And he charged them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, Jesus rebuked Peter, and he said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not on the side of God, but of men." This is the old RSV. And he called to his multitude with his disciples, and he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a person to gain the whole world and forfeit his life? For what can one give in return for his life? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." And he said to them, "Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God has come with power." Need to make a little disclaimer here. Some of you who read widely will have read some of the materials of my most beloved mentor, Dr. Dennis Kinlaw. And you will find some things in his recent writings a lot like what I'm going to share. I can only tell you that this is the result of independent development of conversations had many long years ago. And neither of us is stealing from the other. So you can just, you can kind of picture the scene. Two chapters before this very serious passage we read, the Herod issue is raised by Mark. Oh, Herod's there. He's slobbering. He's salivating all over the place, drooling on his plate because salami is dancing out there, and he's just lost. Man, a holy mackerel. Have you ever seen a woman dance like that? I can't believe it. You know, his eyes are bugging out, and he's laying all over the place, slobbering. And he gets a bit carried away. I mean, this is quite an event. I mean, this is not your everyday dance, apparently. And he's so carried away with the whole thing that he says, "Ask whatever you want up to the half of my kingdom and I'll give it to you." Yes, the half. Ask the whole thing, I'll give it to you. But she winds up asking for the head of John the Baptist. And John the Baptist gets his head taken off from him. And Herod is described as this person whose perception of Jesus is just utterly skewed by guilt. Mark has about a half a dozen different reasons why he's got this paragraph here. But the description is a full description. There aren't any characters in the book of Mark developed more fully than Herod, except Jesus and perhaps John the Baptist. But after that, here's a whole paragraph about this clod. He's presented as a person skewed by his horrendous guilt. He ought to be guilty. He's a sensuous, perverse adulterer, a ruthless killer, a salacious person so captivated by his daughter's dancing that he makes repeated under oath promises that he can't keep. He's got almost unbridled power and the ethical sensitivities of a preschooler. And he's in cold-blooded murder, he kills John the Baptist. He is the quintessential sinner in the book of Mark, a self-centered horrendously evil, powerful, and bad man. Jesus shared that opinion. You remember when Jesus went to Jerusalem? Jesus refused to speak to Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas is the name. There is a brief and very, very clouded passage in Josephus that hints that some of his friends behind his back called him Herod Antipas. But we don't know. It's not certain. I haven't asked Witherington about that particular passage. We may wonder what who cares about Herod? Mark cares. Mark cares about Herod. Why do we need to know about Herod? Well, Mark's the very first verse of Mark's gospel, he tells us what he's about. Referring to the ministry of John the Baptist, he says, "This is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus the Messiah, God's Son." Two agendas. Jesus as Messiah, Jesus as Son of God. And that's what it's going to be. It begins in John the Baptist. And those are the two main agendas of the book, leading a group of people. Other people know this. The demons know who Jesus is. The Father knows who Jesus is. He speaks, "This is my beloved Son." The narrator knows who Jesus is. But the other participants in the story don't know who Jesus is. Jesus knows, of course. And so the book tells a story leading to the discernment of who Jesus is. And Peter finally puts it into words. It's the first major issue, and it's the first, I think, major literary climax of the book, 8:27 to 30, where Jesus asks his disciples to sort out their opinions of who, their judgments of who he is. They say, well, just like we read, some people say you're a prophet. A big prophet. Some say you're Elijah, like we read in Malachi, going to come back. Some say, is this where it says Jeremiah? I don't think Jeremiah gets listed here. But, and Peter says, "I'll tell you who you are. I've thought a lot about this. I suspected it way back there in Galilee, or I wouldn't have got onto this boat. But I think you are the Messiah. You, Jesus, are the one through whom God is going to bring to pass everything he has promised his people through Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Through you, God is going to bring down the Romans. He's going to cast down our enemies. He's going to raise up our people. He's going to conquer the earth for his own good kingdom. He's going to invite the nations to this temple right here. They're going to hear the law, just like Micah said, and the glory of the Lord will cover the earth like the waters cover the seas. That's going to happen. It's going to happen through you, Jesus." And Jesus says, "You're right. Mostly." How did he come to this amazing insight? Well, Mark has a whole chapter before that about this business of how people come to insight that is key in spiritual life. It's a whole segment that is preoccupied with the issues of perception, of hearing, of seeing, of speaking correctly the word of God, of understanding. And Jesus, the story has the disciples trailing along with Jesus. Jesus is healing deaf people. He's healing blind people. He's healing mute people. And the disciples are not getting it. They're out in a boat. They've just seen 5,000 people fed. They have one loaf for 13 people and think they're going to starve. And Jesus says, "You people are not getting it. Don't you hear? Seeing, don't you see? Don't you understand? Are your hearts hard? What is the matter with you?" In a softer voice, he probably said that. But the chapter is about perception. And now we're back to Mark 1, 1 and 2. You remember how it goes? The beginning of the gospel of Jesus, Messiah, God's Son, just as it is written in Isaiah the prophet. And with Jesus and the writer quotes Isaiah, he quotes Exodus, and he quotes Malachi in kind of a mixture, mostly Isaianic. But it's Isaiah, and he lets us already know that one of his chief lenses for understanding Jesus is the prophet Isaiah. And an interesting example of that is in this chapter before the call to discipleship. Because in that chapter, Jesus heals a man who has not been able to hear and consequently was also dumb. His speech is alela. His speech is confused, or he's unable to speak. And when Jesus heals this man, The people around him say, he does everything well. And they quote the passage we read this morning, Isaiah 35. The very next verses. Let's look at that. Isaiah 35, let's see. That's just after Isaiah 34. Yeah, we learned those things in Lake Wobegon. You know, we had just nothing. Just after what we read, listen to this. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, the lame shall leap like the hart, the tongue of the dumb will sing. They are referring to Isaiah. Who is Jesus? He has many identifications. The par excellence, he's Messiah, and he is Son of God, Messianic Son of God. But in this chapter, who is Jesus? He's the one who opens the ears of the deaf, who unstops the tongue of the dumb, who opens the eyes of the blind and clears up the minds of the dull of heart. That's who he is. That's why Matthew says, Peter, you didn't think this up on your own. It was given to you by the living God. Mark says the same thing with different language. Jesus gave Peter that insight. He opened his eyes to the fact that Jesus is the Messiah. But Mark has a second agenda. It's the agenda, and he attaches it to sonship. But it's the agenda of what kind of Messiah is Jesus. It turns out he's a Messiah who is going to fulfill the hopes of the nations, the hopes of Israel for the nations and for themselves. But he is going to fulfill that by serving. He is going to fulfill that by serving in such a way that the culture around him will be so traumatized and so moved that he'll actually wind up dying on a cross. And then he will rise on the third day, mystifying everyone involved. That becomes Mark's second agenda. Just, you saw how it goes in the text. Immediately after Peter says, I know who you are. You are the Messiah. Immediately, says Mark, Jesus began to teach them that he was going to die. And he opens up a section of his book where he gives us, first he gives us this call to discipleship that Jesus says. You know how the text goes. Peter announces that Peter says, you're the Messiah. Then Jesus right away, says immediately, begins to teach the Son of Man is going to suffer and be spit upon and mocked. I forget all how it goes there. And he's going to die, and the third day he'll rise again. He makes that announcement. And then Peter rebukes him instantly. Something about Peter's understanding of Messiah and the idea of a cross and death and suffering did not go together at all. And Peter rebukes. That's a strong word to rebuke the one you've just owned as Messiah. That's like the court jester rebuking the king. And Jesus does not take it well. He rebukes Peter. This is a very important issue. And he says, get behind me, you devil. No, he didn't really say that. He said, get behind me, Satan. I see Satan in you. When you speak like that, you raise all those issues that I've already dealt with and deal with every day of my life. Don't you talk like that in my presence. Get behind me. And besides, when you talk like that, now here we need a better translation than this one. You don't think the thoughts of God. You think just like ordinary people. You think like men. Ordinary, fallen, sinful people, just like Herod. The preceding chapter there where Jesus had been announced, where I said Mark was preoccupied with perception, with hearing, with seeing, with speaking correctly in the name of Christ and understanding. In that chapter, when Jesus looks like he's most frustrated with them, he said, you watch out. Watch out for the leaven of Herod and the leaven of the Pharisees. Now we know why Mark told us so much about Herod. Because Peter's on the surface not like Herod. Of course he isn't. Doesn't have any power, much. He's got some and likes to use it. But he thinks the same way. If he had Herod's power, he'd use it the same way. He may not be as stupidly sensuous as Herod, but he's just as misguided, and on and on. He's just sin writ large. So we have a second agenda, and the agenda is what we are going to do with Peter's confusion, his spiritual schizophrenia. On the one hand, Mark is very, very clear. The disciples are not Herod. They are not the Pharisees. They are not the crowd. They are not the elders. They are disciples. They have given up what they have to follow Jesus. They have made a good faith response to the proclamation. The kingdom is at hand. Repent. Trust the good news of the kingdom. Follow me. Fish for men. They've responded to that call authentically. But they still think just like Herod. And they think like the Pharisees. Mark gives us a picture of the Pharisees. It's a different kind of picture. Same song, different verse. Same sin, different clothing. But these are people, in essence, for whom the issue is a matter of identity. We so often, in a rather anti-Semitic way, we trivialize the questions that the Pharisees bring to Jesus. They are not a bunch of legalists. Legalism is not the point. The point is identity. Where do I find what defines who I am? Who we are. And Mark says it was in the doing of Torah. Jesus said your identity needs to be not in the doing of Torah, but in utter devotion to the one who gave you the Torah. The Sabbath is not for men. Yeah, how's that go? Just when you get to make a point, it falls right out of your head. Human beings weren't made for Sabbath. Sabbath was given, was made for human beings. Don't keep the honor of your parents by doing the korban, where you circumvent the law. No, live what you think the lawgiver wanted you to live. It was a matter of identity, deep, profound identity. These were godly people gone astray. Jesus warned Peter and the rest about that. Be careful. Leaven, a little dab will do you. A little bit goes a long ways. It permeates everything you are, how you think, how you talk, how you identify yourself. And it'll affect everything you do. Well, Mark picks up this business. And he takes Jesus' invitation to deny ourselves, to take up the cross, follow Jesus, this simple thing that Jesus asked to do. Oh, golly. And he constructs a narrative exposition. He expounds by little vignettes, chrei, the technical word is, little episodes that expound what it means to think the thoughts of men. Not to think like God, not to deny ourselves, not to take up the cross. He teaches by and large, by contrast, and he builds it around these three pillars, these announcements of the cross, and beside them he puts paragraphs, which stand in contrast to the mind of Jesus who will go to the cross. And they give pictures of what it might be like, other pictures to help you see what it would mean if you actually took up the cross and followed Jesus, how would that get lived out? For instance, he gives this announcement in 9:30 to 32 about his cross. And then the very next paragraph is this paragraph where the disciples, when they get in the house, Jesus asked them, what were you talking about along the way? And they didn't want to tell him because they were talking about who was the greatest. It's okay. Who is the greatest? This is a big deal in Palestine. Palestine was an honor-shame culture. Who is the greatest is an important and legitimate question to ask. Who are the head honchos here? Who are the ones who are obliged to serve the others, to make sure the others look good in public and such like? Who are these people? Jesus asked them about that. He obviously cared about what they thought. Then he took a child He said, I want to teach you something. He said, if you want to be great, be last. If you want to be the leader, be the servant of all. Then he gave this little kid a hug. He said, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And not just me, but the one who sent me. And notice he's not talking about just being friendly. I'm a hugger, so I hug kids. Or I like children, as I'm a lover. I do. I love little kids. Bless their hearts. But that's not the issue. That's not the issue. The issue is a social issue. The issue for the disciples is having room in their lives for people who don't count. The issue is a whole set of values as to who is important and who is not important. And Jesus says, not just a matter of friendliness, it's a matter of devotion in my name. Whoever receives one such child in my name. And so there's a little picture. What would it mean not to deny oneself? It would mean not to have room for children, for the little ones, for people who don't have a voice in culture. What would it mean to take up the cross and follow Jesus? Among other things, it would mean to have room for children, for little ones. And this is not just some individual piety. This will affect the culture, the social structures of the group in which you move. And he has another paragraph about the rich ruler who wants to come to Jesus. Now he's picking up, what will it if you give all, you know? And the man is sad because he's done everything he ought to do, but he can't release what he has and trust God to care for him and thus enter the kingdom. And when push comes to shove, he's actually willing to part with the kingdom as opposed to parting with his goods. And Jesus says that kind of thinking, it's not an issue of are you wealthy or not wealthy, it's an issue of can you hold things loosely for the sake of the kingdom? What owns you? What defines you? What delights you? And there's one real, real interesting one. In 10:32 to 34, you have this third announcement of the cross, and right after that is the paragraph where James and John come to Jesus, and they ask Jesus, they say, Lord, we'd like you to do, well, actually, whatever we want you to do, we'd like you to do. And Jesus asks, what would you like me to do? And they say, well, we'd like to be Secretary of State and Minister of Foreign Affairs in the new kingdom that is coming. Jesus says, I can't, those are not mine to give. And then he teaches them about being a servant. He says, if you want to be great, be a servant. Why be a servant? Because I am a servant. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. I mean to give his life for a ransom for many. Notice what these people are doing. It's another power play. It's Herod all over again, isn't it? And these are disciples of Jesus. They want to be put in positions where they can tell their friends what to do. They even want to be able to determine the will of the Messiah. Lord, do for us whatever we ask you. Look at that. Look at that. This is what it means. It's an exposition of the discipleship. And then there's one last paragraph. There's the paragraph about blind Bartimaeus, this beggar by the road. Jesus is coming up from Jericho, I think it is. It's a big crowd. They're going up to Jerusalem. Chapter 11, verse 1 is going to be what we call the triumphal entry. And he passes by blind Bartimaeus. Bartimaeus calls out, and the people around him, shut up, be quiet. The Lord doesn't have time for people like you. For heaven's sake, get a life. But he won't be quiet. He's calling out, son of David, Messiah, right? Son of David, you're the messianic son. Jesus says, hey, who is that? Bring him to me. So he comes and Jesus asks him the same question he asked James and John. What would you like me to do for you? And the man says, now remember chapter 8 where he healed the blind man? Took two touches, but he healed him. What does this fellow say? He says, Lord, I'd really like to see. I'd like to be able to see who you are. I'd like to see the world the way it actually is. No, I remember some things I think, but man, I'd like to see. Jesus says, your faith has made you well. So what Mark does is he takes this exposition of what it would mean to deny the cross. He takes this exposition of spiritual schizophrenia, and he wraps it around sight. Chapter 8 and the last paragraph. Jesus is the one who, he can open your eyes. He really can. Now, I'll tell you what. We got to finish up. But spiritual schizophrenia is not something limited to Peter. Mark knew that's why he wrote the book the way he did. And if you want to know what personal holiness is just following Jesus. It's following Jesus in the shape of the cross, the cruciform life defined in these simple ways, but actually earth-shaking, socially impacting, structure-changing ways. Not just, it is personal piety, but it's not just personal piety. It changes everything. And so what I want to announce to you is that whereas you cannot break your own, and I cannot break my own dullness of heart, I cannot open my eyes wide enough to see well who Jesus wants me to be. I cannot open my ears sufficiently to hear his word as I ought. Jesus can do it. That's the amazing thing. And there is something that you Methodists, see, they wanted somebody to speak about personal holiness. They said, the Wesleyans do that. I know what, Walt. Well, there are two of us on campus, Donjel and me. We don't have any. We're the sanctified brethren. We don't have many people here. We're good, but we don't have many. And the Methodists, they'll do the social holiness stuff, right? What was I trying to say? I was trying to say that the Methodists have got it right and Wesley had it right. In some senses, we are always going on to perfection. Always, every day of our life, we will be doing that probably throughout all eternity. But there are other senses in which it really is possible here and now to make a transition from persons whose lives are governed by thinking like Herod and the Pharisees and persons whose lives are governed by the thoughts of Jesus. We are not flawless. We are not sinless. But it really is the fact that God takes some persons and he enables them to think like Jesus. Especially and profoundly at the point of what it means to go to the cross and rise again. And I, even though it is 11:52, I would be really remiss if I didn't invite you to listen to the one who opens the eyes of the blind and unstops the ears of the deaf. And if you find yourself at a point of saying, that's me, I am spiritually schizophrenic. I'm working and working and working, but my mind is going the other direction. This may be a morning when God is calling you to give yourself to him in such a way that he can open your eyes. And he can open your ears and unstop your lips to speak in ways that truly do incarnate the soul and mind and heart and ways of Jesus. That's doable, not because we do it, but because Christ does this miracle. So we're just going to sing, and if Christ has spoken to you in a way that you need to respond to that at an altar, you're welcome to come. There are many, many ways to respond to something like this. You do what is best for you, but we'll carve out a little time here to do that. Should we just let people go both ways, or... Let's stand and we'll have Wesley, we'll sing a minute and then we'll dismiss, okay?